it would negatively impact the fluidity of the nation's rail system. And then when Trump came into office, they turned around and pushed for Trump to repeal the brake rules that the Obama administration had enacted, which he did.
So we're talking about rules that went back to the Civil War. They haven't been updated?
So the brakes currently on America's freight trains are air brakes, which function by stopping train cars one at a time using pressure that travels along a pipe along the train. And that is a brake system that was designed in 1868.
Astounding. You have 10 seconds for a final comment about what people should understand about East Palestine right now.
So, yeah, this is the result of efforts by the railroad industry to ensure that they do not have to retrofit trains carrying hazardous materials and crude oil with safety features.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Julia Rock of The Lever, Ross Gruters, locomotive engineer and co-chair of Railroad Workers United, and Emily Wright of River Valley Organizing. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanjay Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Happy birthday, Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction, human rights, civil rights, and much more. Tune in and listen to Free Culture Radio on the third Wednesday of each month from 6:30 to 7 p.m. Pacific here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, tax penalties for high-income earners who didn't pay into homeless services or preschool for all are waived by Multnomah County. Oregon public school enrollment continues a three-year decline. And Washington legislators consider a bill to allow ranked choice voting in presidential elections. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 14th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. Metro and Multnomah County will waive penalties and interest for people who didn't pay their supportive housing tax and preschool for all tax in 2021. This comes after public outcry from folks who didn't know they owed the tax until a letter demanding payment came in the mail. County officials say they tried to reach people through employers and accountants. TurboTax, a popular tax preparation software, also didn't tell people that they were going to owe these taxes to the county. Both of these taxes target only higher income earners. The taxes are used to fund homeless services and preschool. For people who did pay the penalty and interest, they'll get a full refund. But going forward, the taxes will be in effect, and if people don't pay into them, the penalty and interest will be in effect. Oregon public schools are noticing a decline in student enrollment for the third year in a row. School funding is tied to that attendance, so less students could mean less money for Oregon's public schools. KBOO's Josh Salem has more.
School enrollment in Oregon public schools dropped for the third straight year. This year, the decline was smaller than in years past, which could be a sign that enrollment is stabilizing. Yet, the state does not know where a lot of students are actually going. Before 2020, enrollment in Oregon's public schools increased for 9 years straight. That trend changed as most Oregon schools closed for in-person teaching during the first years of the COVID-19 pandemic. In the 2020 to 2021 school year, enrollment declined 3.7%, and the next year it fell again by 1.4%. That's more than in most neighboring states, where enrollment either grew or leveled off in 2021. California did experience a drop, but public school enrollment has been declining there since 2017. This year, statewide enrollment in Oregon public schools dropped 0.1% from last year. That equals a loss of 632 students. For the past few years, the number of students lost comes to more than 30,000. Enrollment at Oregon's bigger school districts varied. Portland, Salem-Keizer, and Beaverton are the three largest school districts in Oregon. They all lost students this year. But North Clackamas and Eugene gained in numbers. School district funding is tied to the number of students served, so fewer students generally means fewer state dollars. On the other hand, Oregon schools face a deadline to spend pandemic relief funds by around this time next year. Officials think the move to distance learning may have led to the enrollment drop in the early years of the pandemic, but they do not understand why there was no rebound after schools returned to in-person instruction. The most recent national enrollment data shows an enrollment decline from 2019 to 2020, but across the nation, enrollment came back up in the fall of 2021. Many families left Oregon, while others found alternative schooling options like homeschooling. Factoring those in, there are thousands of school-aged children who are still in Oregon but not in the public schools. In fact, that figure probably exceeds 20,000. Some speculate that other dynamics may be at play, like discipline issues, disengagement, inflexibility, and other structural issues. School districts are required to try to contact students who have left enrollment without a documented transfer to another educational setting. Over the last 4 years, officials say the decline in enrollment has been concentrated among white students and kindergartners. Legislators are considering whether to require the state education department to collect data on students attending private schools or homeschooling. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A bill in the Washington state legislature would bring ranked choice voting to presidential primaries in the state. Washington voters have expressed regret that their preferred candidates sometimes drop out before their votes are counted and primaries come to their state. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Supporters of ranked choice voting say the system could improve Washington state's presidential primary elections. A bill in Olympia would create a ranked system in presidential primaries in which candidates are ranked by a voter's preference. Stephanie Houghton is managing director of Fair Vote Washington, which is supporting the bill. She says it would alleviate a problem caused when voters are asked to vote early, including in primaries.
Unfortunately, if you did that in the 2020 primary, you were punished, possibly, because your vote was cast for someone who then dropped out. There are no redos.
Houghton says voters in the 2020 Democratic primary later expressed regret that their vote didn't matter. Washington State's Democratic and Republican primaries were in March in 2020, more than a month after the Iowa caucuses, the first contest in the country. In 2022, Seattle voters approved a measure to bring ranked choice voting to city primary elections. Houghton says after the primaries, the ranked choice ballots would be in the hands of the parties to decide what to do with them. She says as it stands now, people have to strategize about which candidate is going to be viable by the time the primary gets to their state.
Instead of just saying, my favorite candidate is blank, I'm going to vote for that person. If they don't make the threshold set by the party, I would like my vote to go toward the second person. Same for the third.
She says the state would join a host of other states that used ranked choice voting in primaries and caucuses in 2020, including Alaska, Hawaii, Kansas, and Wyoming. Maine is joining those states in 2024. Time to advance this bill, though, is running out. It needs to be voted out of the House State Government and Tribal Relations Committee by Friday to stay in play this legislative session. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
An incident involving use of deadly force by Portland police over the weekend is under investigation. Cops pulled over a man in Northwest Portland in response to reports of a stolen car. As the man reached under the seat, police struck him on the head with a shotgun. The man in the car was 32-year-old Brian Bruman, who was later booked in Multnomah County Jail. Police say they found a knife and a replica gun in the car and that Bruman didn't comply with their orders. Bruman was taken to the hospital for his injuries. Anytime police use a firearm, a carotid neck hold, or strike to the head, neck, or throat, it's considered use of deadly force. That means there will be an internal review of the use of force. The internal review then goes in front of the police review board. New bureau policy states that the officer will be named within 15 days. The U.S. denies flying intelligence balloons over China. 5 years later, survivors remember a horrendous school shooting, and Carrie Lake is still claiming the 2022 Arizona gubernatorial election was stolen. With more on the story, It's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are not flying surveillance balloons over China. I'm not aware of any other craft that we're flying over into Chinese airspace.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby addressed concerns raised by the Chinese government about the U.S. flying intelligence balloons into their airspace. The U.S. shot down a balloon from China gathering intelligence on the U.S. and several other unidentified flying objects in the past few days. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the crafts are still being investigated. 5 years after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, survivors are opening up about gun violence in schools. According to the K-12 school shooting database, there were 114 school shooting events in 2020, climbing to 250 in 2021 and 300 in 2022. Delaney Tarr, a co-founder of the March for Our Lives, described how the shooting has impacted her.
I don't know if we ever really understood how we were going to have longevity. That was a big concern for us, but it was also, once again, a symptom of trauma. Can't really look into the future at all. So we didn't have the ability to say, where will we be 5 years from now? Our goal, of course, was to not have to exist 5 years from now.
After the mass shootings at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, and in Buffalo in 2022, lawmakers passed legislation encouraging states to pass red flag laws, which allow groups to petition courts to remove weapons from threatening people, and expanded background checks for people wanting to buy guns. During the National Association of Counties Legislative Conference, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy addressed what has been the cause of declining youth mental health. He noted that while the youth mental health crisis has been exacerbated by the pandemic, there is another layer to it.
Behind the youth mental health crisis is a mental health crisis among parents who are struggling themselves to figure out how to care for their children while they themselves are dealing with stress and anxiety, often at unprecedented levels.
Kari Lake, the former Arizona Republican gubernatorial candidate, still claims she won the 2022 election, parroting rhetoric from former President Donald Trump. During a speech to an Iowa Republican women's group, Lake said she's committed to her case, even if this means going all the way to the Supreme Court. She's confident the Arizona Court of Appeals decision will prove she won once and for all.
We're about to find out truly how corrupt our system is, because we have a mountain of evidence and we have the law on our side. And if we cannot contest elections that are dirty, rotten, horrible, stolen elections, then we're in trouble.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Food assistance programs got a boost in funding over the pandemic, but those extra funds are ending soon. Washington state lawmakers are considering a bill that would provide funds to food assistance as a federal food aid program cuts back on increased pandemic benefits. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
The pandemic-era boost to federal food aid is scheduled to end soon, but legislation in Olympia aims to help fill the gap in hunger relief. The emergency allotments for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, increased food assistance during COVID-19, but will expire in March. House Bill 1784 in the Washington State Legislature would provide $28 million in food aid as early as April, if it passes. Jake Garcia with Northwest Harvest says the end of emergency allotments will mean drastic cuts in aid for vulnerable populations.
It's going to hurt folks who are seniors and people with disabilities the most. And so they'll actually go from receiving $218 a month to about $23 a month in basic food benefits. So it's a cliff.
The bill in Olympia would allocate funds for hunger relief organizations and programs for older Washingtonians and incentivizing fruit and vegetable purchases for low-income Washingtonians. It has a public hearing on Monday and is scheduled for an executive session on Thursday. Head of the Bellingham Food Bank, Mike Cohen, says people are in need, and that will increase once emergency allotments for SNAP end. He says when other pandemic benefit programs started ending in 2022, the change was significant.
We really saw a sharp spike in shopper visits to our food bank that we were not prepared for. We thought we might get busier, but we doubled our weekly number of visits and continue to hold that pace, and it's growing.
Garcia says Washingtonians also are struggling with high food prices. He hopes lawmakers take into account people's lived experiences with hunger, noting that the conversations for families is more dire than the one happening in the Capitol.
The conversations at dinner tables is, hey, we don't have milk, we don't have eggs, we don't have the staples. It's a radically different conversation, and I think that's something that is getting lost on some of our legislators in Olympia.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Paradigms. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather in the metro area will be mostly clear with a low of 33 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy with a high of 45. Today in history, in 1859, Oregon is admitted as the 33rd U.S. state. The quote of the day is from former Oregon Governor Tom McCall in his address to the 1973 legislature. He said, quote, "Oregon is an inspiration. Whether you come to it or are born to it, you become entranced by our state's beauty, the opportunity she affords, and the independent spirit of her citizens." Indigenous leaders in Alberta, Canada, are calling for an apology for a video the new premier of Alberta published on Twitter. They say it's hurtful to the cause of truth and reconciliation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous leaders are demanding an apology from the new premier of Alberta for a video published on Twitter. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they're calling the tweet disappointing and harmful to truth and reconciliation.
The video was made while Danielle Smith was in Ottawa for a major premier's conference on healthcare. The video taken on Parliament Hill had Smith reflecting on the origins of Canada and her interpretation of history.
Many years ago, the Indigenous people of this land and those that came from across the world united to tame an unforgiving frontier.
Native leaders called the video dehumanizing and demoralizing, and they want an apology. Jessica Salkeld is with the Reconciliation Action Group.
If she knows anything about that history, she ought to know that what she's saying is a bold-faced lie.
Dwayne Bratt is a political science professor at Mount Royal University.
This was a scripted video with a message that she wanted to deliver, and it is just so historically inaccurate.
The video has since been criticized by many who say Smith is revising parts of history and ignoring a dark chapter of Canadian history. Others say they're concerned about Smith's lack of understanding. Smith said the partnership with First Nations is one she values, but she did not apologize. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Tuksuk Bay, a remote town off the coast of western Alaska, is home to Yupik culture and the social media sensation Noah Loves Christy. KNBA's Jill Freitas brings us their love story.
Noah and Christy Lincoln have been married for almost 20 years, have 6 kids, and a brand new granddaughter. The couple make reenactments of famous movies and TV shows with a twist of Native humor. They have over 40,000 followers on Facebook and 20,000 on TikTok. And it all started, they say, while out hunting for geese with their son.
We had our son just take the camera and start recording.
Noah had Christy do different bird calls, from ravens to geese to even a sexy swan.
Be a sexy swan.
They posted the video to their Facebook page, where it was shared and reshared hundreds of times. It was at that moment Noah and Christy knew they were onto something big.
And I thought, man, we could get so many people to laugh if just me and my wife.
After the release of the show Reservation Dogs on Hulu, Native humor has been trending on social media. But Alaska humor is a little different. It usually draws from subsistence hunting, fishing, and guns, like this video.
16 years I've been married, and my wife said she don't love me anymore.
All I said is you're not getting a new gun.
It's the same thing.
It's not.
But life wasn't always a comedy for Noah. Early in his life, he says he struggled with an addiction.
I was heavily into alcohol, and I couldn't keep a job.
After realizing what this was doing to his family, Noah swore off alcohol. But did he stay sober?
I'm so happy to say yes. We're always thanking God for everything.
No matter your culture, laughter is universal. That is one thing Noah and Christy supply plenty of. But they also make it a point to sprinkle in inspirational videos with messages of hope that go on to say that at the end of the day, family and faith are everything. I'm Jill Freitas.
The National Congress of American Indians Winter Session and State of Indian Nations Address are returning to the nation's capital in person next week for the first time in 3 years. Tribal leaders from across the country will hear updates from the White House, U.S. lawmakers, and federal officials. NCAI President Fawn Sharp will lay out priorities for the year. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Trade justice advocates will be protesting in front of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference, which starts today in Palm Springs, asking that the next big trade deal take workers and the environment into account. Suzanne Potter has more.
Protesters will be in Palm Springs at noon today to draw attention to ongoing negotiations on a huge international trade deal, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. Trade negotiators from the U.S. and 13 other countries are attending the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference over the next 2 weeks. Will Jamil Wilchko with the California Trade Justice Coalition says any deal needs to be worker-centered and climate-friendly.
It can't be another backroom deal that helps big corporations offshore jobs, drive down wages, and ignore environmental rules.
Labor and environmental groups are asking for a seat at the table, but they say they have not been fully included thus far. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative did not respond to a request for comment. The Biden administration says the trade deal will strengthen ties to the Indo-Pacific region and aims for a stronger, fairer, more resilient economy. Wilchko says he'd like to see the largest industrial nations sign a climate peace clause where they pledge to stop dragging each other before the World Trade Organization to block programs that cut down on carbon emissions.
Countries have been fighting policies that could combat climate change with the argument that it infringes on a multinational corporation within their country's right to profit, which makes it so that we can't really take much action on climate change.
Advocates are also asking for close scrutiny of any digital trade provisions that could make it easier for companies to sell personal data. And they want more transparency in the computer algorithms that power potentially discriminatory software programs like those used for facial recognition or for evaluating employee performance. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Inflation and its effects on food, gas, and other basic necessities in the U.S. has eased since last year. But many rural households hit hardest by the 2021-22 inflationary episode are still feeling the pain. Roz Brown reports in New Mexico.
Many economists believe inflation will further ease this year, and that can't come soon enough for overburdened rural Americans, including those in New Mexico. The Consumer Price Index, the main indicator of inflation, looks at the prices that urban Americans pay for a set basket of goods. Economy professor Stephen Weiler with Colorado State University says people in rural America are not surveyed, leaving out relevant data on 14% of the U.S. population, or around 46 million people.
And it's also this segment of the population that is likely to be economically disadvantaged. And just because you're in a place that has disadvantages shouldn't mean that you're also disadvantaged by the system as a whole.
By necessity, rural Americans tend to drive more because they have longer commutes to work, grocery stores, and essential services like education and health care. When transportation costs rise, rural folks especially end up with less discretionary income, according to an Iowa State University report. About 30% of New Mexico's population lives in rural areas. Net farm income was forecast to decline 4.5% in 2022, which is still 26% higher than the 10-year average, according to Ag America. But Weiler points out that even when agriculture has a good year, that doesn't mean rural residents have a good year.
Rural is a lot of different things, and it's not ag. I mean, I think a lot of people basically equate rural with ag, but 90% of rural income comes from non-ag sources. There are a few family farms out there, but they're relatively few and far between.
Weiler believes higher prices may be chipping away at paychecks of rural Americans at a higher rate than is being tracked by the federal government, which he believes should change the way it collects data.
Having worked in various rural parts of the country, rural California, rural Appalachia, it's gotten to the point where even those people are saying, we actually need place-based policy. It's not enough to focus on the people, that places really actually matter.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
China put a great deal of effort towards economic diplomacy to make inroads in Europe. Despite China's support of the Russian war in Ukraine, trade ties remain strong with the Europeans. We now go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. With all the attention on U.S.-China relations, Beijing's on-again, off-again relations with the European Union don't receive the attention they deserve. In the short space of a few decades, Europe, in Chinese eyes, has gone from being a pole in a multipolar world to being a major target of China's attention. China was the third largest partner for EU exports of goods in 2021 and the largest partner for Chinese imports. Some of the same issues that plagued the relationship remain from the early 2000s, such as China's human rights policies and a European arms embargo. But now, China's economic diplomacy, trade and investments in Europe, mostly under the so-called Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI, is at the center of Beijing's approach to Europe. David Chambaugh, writing several years ago in one of the first major works on China-Europe relations, noted that, quote, China's Europe watchers are almost uniformly upbeat and optimistic. They praise EU policy as being enlightened and far-sighted, and they take great satisfaction in the China-EU Comprehensive Strategic Partnership proclaimed in 2003. Nonetheless, Chinese analysts are constantly looking for fault lines across the Atlantic, which can possibly be exploited by China. Some see the U.S. and EU trying to collectively manipulate or pressure China, for example, on questions of human rights, trade policy, political liberalization, and civil society development. Shift to the present, and we find that China's often clumsy and abrasive diplomacy, carried out by wolf warrior diplomats, the Xinjiang genocide, and Beijing's support of Putin's war on Ukraine have to some extent poisoned the well. EU governments have become wary of China's economic power. They finally abandoned the strategy of change through trade, that is, viewing trade as an instrument for liberalizing China's politics. Following the U.S. lead, the EU has, for example, rejected Huawei 5G technology, sharply criticized China's human rights policies, and decided not to ratify a comprehensive agreement on investment that had been concluded in December 2020. Chinese efforts to punish European intellectuals and academic institutions that criticize Beijing's repression have backfired, justifying the hesitancy of the principal EU governments to deal with China. So-called European values seem to have more salience than national interests, a shift that Chinese Europe watchers decried. But that was in the Angela Merkel era. Things are different now. Money is talking loudly again. Neither China's human rights practices nor its backing of Russia have seriously damaged trade and investment ties, a development contrary to the view of some observers that the EU would significantly toughen its China policy. China's BRI remains a fixture in Italy and Greece, where China has bought port facilities. Chinese investors have bought up 35 German firms, and European companies are still heavily invested in China. European political leaders are again flocking to China in the post-COVID period in search of deals. In fact, British and EU leaders are reportedly going to meet with the visiting Xinjiang province head, a reputed intern camp defender. Some people are calling for him to be jailed in England. To be sure, Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany says that Germany rejects hegemonic Chinese dominance. He has vowed to reduce risky trade dependencies with China and insist on reciprocity when it comes to intellectual property rights and market access. But he has made clear that Germany will not decouple its economy from China or embrace trade protectionism. And that is the EU's position as a whole, an important contrast with the US, where decoupling from China is part of the bipartisan consensus in Congress. As France's foreign finance minister clarified at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, China cannot be out, China must be in, he said. This is the difference of view we have between the US and Europe. We don't want to oppose China, we want to engage with China, we want China to obey by the same rules. That is also what the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, Henry M. Paulson, also advised about, warning that U.S. efforts to isolate China will backfire. Quote, Although many countries share Washington's antipathy to China's policies, practices, and conduct, no country is emulating Washington's playbook for addressing these concerns. It is true that nearly every major U.S. partner is tightening up its export controls on sensitive technologies, and so on, but even Washington's closest strategic partners are not prepared to confront, attempt to contain, or economically de-integrate China as broadly as the United States is. What seems apparent is that the EU's attempt to have it both ways, talk principles and walk profits, continues. Rhetoric often masks economic and political self-interest, which should surprise no one. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 14th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings. And our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Mark Richardson, Suzanne Potter, and Roz Brown. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth.